Now, all of the speakers in this series travel here from somewhere else, so I'd like to talk to you about traveling. This is a metaphor, and it is a metaphor for thinking about cognition and how we work. You know, when we travel, we take a little compressed suitcase of stuff. And the little compressed suitcase of stuff is designed to fit in the world. That is, it goes in the baggage handling machine. In airports I've never been in, by the way, the baggage handling machine in Beijing airport is the best I have ever seen. And I think that may be the biggest airport I have ever seen, and that's really saying something. And the rolling bag goes in the overhead compartment of the plane. Planes I've never seen before. Airports I've never been in. It goes down runways and walkways that I've never seen before. And inside the rolling bag, I have some stuff. So, for example, I have this little electrical supply for my computer. And it goes and plugs into the world. It plugs into parts of the world that I have never been in. It plugs into places that have current of 110 volts, and it plugs into places that have current of 220, and places where the current is 50 hertz, and places where the current is 60 hertz. And I leave my house with this little power brick, knowing that somehow I will be able to make it plug into the world. And if it doesn't really plug into the world, I have another little thing that I carry in my bag, and sometimes I have to pop out this one to make it plug into the world. And sometimes I have to pop out this one to make it plug into the world. And mine always plugs in here, but for, you know, Asian plugs into the world. There are very goofy ones, of course, like the British. The British, very large here. Something like this, you have these in Hong Kong. And so I put together this thing with that thing and these things that are in the wall, see? And amazing, it works, right? See, I do this and I plug this in. Oh, I need the other one, see? Okay, this one, yeah, good. And there are little microphones that plug into me. Okay? And I take my toothbrush. I don't take water. I think there's going to be water there where I go. Yeah? And I take my clothes, but I don't take hangers. When I travel, I can't take my whole house with me. I don't say, oh, I need some place to live. I think I'll take my whole house and all of the plumbing supplies and all of the electrical generation in my city. And I better take my car too. And I better take all of my office with my books. I don't have to do that. I take this small, compressed, packed bunch of stuff. And some of the stuff I take is in this little tiny thing. Little tiny thing. And just the way the bag fits in the airplane, this fits in my pocket. And I have a pocket. And I can put all kinds of things in my pocket and take them out of my pocket. And when I leave my house, I have my pockets, and I have my wallet, and I have my passport. Amazing thing, passport. Everybody all over the world looks at it and says, oh, okay. And I have my little rolling bag. And when I get somewhere, I unpack it. I unpack the cord and I take out the money and I say, hi, I have this money. Do you take this money? No, this is no good money. Do you take this money? Yes, we take that money. Okay, fine. And if I don't have any money, then I say, ah, well, do you take this little piece of plastic? Yeah? They say, okay, fine, little piece of plastic. And people say, who are you? And I say, I'm this person. Okay? All this stuff right here, little packed. I unpack it when I get there. And I can work with what I find. And people can work with me. Now, when I pack back up to go home, my bag is pretty much the way I brought it, but not exactly. It changes a little. Because when I unpack my stuff and use it, and then I repack, maybe I find a slightly better way to pack. Or maybe where I went, there was something that was just a little better than the thing that I brought, so I replace it. Or maybe I lose something, and I get something there, and I take back in my packed bag to go to the next place a slightly different packed set of stuff. Now, I would like to suggest that this is a better metaphor for thinking about how we work with the world and how thought works and how meaning is developed than the metaphor in which we have all the stuff in our head and we just pull it out and use it, right? Everything that I know, everything that you know, including all of our linguistic competence, our linguistic performance, is not all here. No, it develops when we unpack our constructions, we unpack our mechanisms for thinking. We build a network, a conceptual network. We build expressions. We take in expressions when people say them. We use the constructions we have to try to make sense of these expressions. We build the network and we pack the network back up. And we take away with us little compressed mental frames, little compressed linguistic constructions that we can unpack again the next place. The next place we go, the money will work or we can convert it. The toothbrush will find some water. The electricity will plug into something. And if it doesn't, well, we have his credit card and we can buy some new stuff when we get there. Packing and unpacking. This, I think, is what we're doing all the time. Now, I want to point out that linguistically, there needs to be some kind of model of linguistic knowledge along these lines. And here I will say why. We have heard today wonderful presentations on diversity and change. And we can see why it is that some parts of language would change. These are what we call open class items. So, for example, although grammatical categories are closed class, noun, verb, adjective, things like that, the individual items that go in that category are open class, which means you can add to them very easily. So, the word fax, meaning send something to somebody through the telephone line, and which comes from the word facsimile, did not exist until I was out of college. But that's easy. You just make a new verb. If you discover a new planet, you make a new noun. Now, the fact that it's a noun and can go in certain kinds of positions, that's closed class. The fact that you can make a new one, and we just agree on it easily, that's open class. Okay, so everybody understands why open class aspects of language would change. Because there's new meaning and you want a new word. Fine. But how about closed class? Things like modal verbs. Modal verbs in English and other languages are things like will, shall, could, can, would, might, may, must. Now, you know, the modal verb system in English is different now than it was in the 14th century. Why? Why would it change? If you're always just pulling out the knowledge you have and using it there, and then it goes away, why would what you pull out ever change? Why would the modal system of English have changed over time? That needs an explanation, because languages change. They change gradually in their closed class systems. They change gradually in their pronunciations. Why would that be? We have to have a reason. If we think that our linguistic knowledge or our linguistic performance comes from pulling out static knowledge we have and using it and letting it go, then there's no reason that what we know would change for closed class items. It has to be something about the way human beings use language that results in the kind of changes that we see. It is true that we see variation and diversity, but it is not random. Things do not just change willy-nilly. They change according to various kinds of regularities. And that is always what we are trying to explain about human cognition. How do we get diversity over regularity? Because human performance always has these features: diversity and change, but with strong regularity across, and regularity even in how we change. So let's talk about mental packing and unpacking. That's the subject for today. My machine will now comply. Yes. And what we're trying to explain here is language and why human beings have the kind of language that they have. So, in order to operate in the world, we have to, as Charles Goodwin and Ed Hutchins say, we have to be portable. Our knowledge has to be portable. Our ability has to be portable. We have to carry it with us. And it has to be able to occupy available bandwidth. What that means is it has to fit in to the ecological affordances of the situations in which we find ourselves. Well, my suggestion is that we think about doing that by mental packing and unpacking. So I'm trying to contrast two things. One would be a notion of language ability and knowledge, in fact, as retrieval and use. So think you have a tool shed, right? Or you have a toolbox. Gee, now you need your wrench, so you go get your wrench and you use it. Or you have a concept of coffee, and you go get your concept of coffee and you use it. Or you just go and get these things that you have. They're all fully fleshed out, and you pull them up and use them. And what I want to contrast that with is the idea of generation and unpacking, and then repacking. So here's an example. Here's a sundial. Okay? Now, if you don't have the shadow in the sundial is useless as a sundial. It might be pretty, memorable, and so on, but it's useless as a sundial. Now, where does the shadow come from? It's not the case that the sundial pulls it up and puts it in the right place. It's not the case that I pull it out of my head when I need to see a shadow. It's in the environment. I know how to read a sundial. I carry that with me. And I run across this thing, and the sundial is in place, and there is a sun, and the system produces a mark. The system of the sun and the sundial produce a mark. Now, was the shadow there? Was it retrieved by the system? Was it used by the system? No. It results when you put the other parts of the system into place. So you can kind of think of a sundial as one of the little things that you carry around in your suitcase. Although in this case, what you're carrying around in your suitcase is your knowledge of how to read a sundial. And in fact, what you're carrying around is probably something more like the ability to infer how to read a sundial on the basis of knowing that symbols leave marks, the variable part of the symbol indicates what's variable for the frame, the static parts of the symbol tend to indicate what's regular. So you pack and you unpack just the way, and you end up with knowing what time it is, just the way the sundial sort of ends up telling you what time it is, but not because the shadow is always there or got pulled out of the container. It comes up in the moment of use. It is generated or implicit in the system within context. When you place that system into a context, you get something that works. But it is not in any sense retrieved or just used. So the conception that I'm talking about here is change and unification. Languages change. They get unified into little bits of stuff. So the way I'm going to be talking for the next six lectures about language is language knowledge is as consisting of small packed constructions that you can put together in the presence of situations in such a way as to make a network that works in the situation. But then you don't keep the whole network active. It goes away. You let go of the network. But it's part of these blending networks that the way you create knowledge is involved in the construction of the network. And when you make a network, that can change the knowledge that you have. Just like my little packet, my little suitcase of stuff, can change a little as I go through the world. And I've just come from Portugal. I unpacked in Portugal, and I come to Beijing, and I unpack, and I work here, and then I fold this back up. And the next place I'm going to go is Ohio. And then after that, I'm going to go to Berkeley. And I don't take with me everything that I generated in any one of those places. But what I do take is a set of constructions that I can put together to make a new network the next place I go. Okay? So I want to talk about the way we pack things. Some of the principles of the way we can use conceptual blending to pack things down into something we can carry, but then unpack it to make sense of things, right? And the utility of these things is in the network. So think of an expression like, in a leap year, we add a day to February. It seems perfectly normal. Does everybody understand that? Does everybody understand this phrase? Every 4 years, we have to add one day to the year? Okay. Well, now think about that for a minute. What is the year? What is February? In your experience, there's just one day, and then another day, and then another day, and then another day, and another day. And another day, and another day, and another day, and it never ends. There is no February out there that's one thing, right? And there is no year that's out there that's one thing. Of course, there's one day, and another day, and another day, and that was this year. We take all of those things, and there are analogies and disanalogies, and we pack them down into a thing, one thing, from many to one. Now there's one thing. There's the year, right? And it repeats. Now years do not repeat, let me tell you. It's not like the movie Groundhog Day, where the day really does repeat. It's never happened that on January 1st, I've awakened, and it's the same as the last year. I'm never the same age I was a year ago. My children are never the same age as they were a year ago. Every year is different. It's not true that the year repeats. But we pack all of this into one little packet. It's like my electric converter or my power brick. And it's really useful because I can unpack. When I'm in a new year, I understand that year, and I understand the years before and the years after, but I have this concept of a year. And now that I've got this one thing, I can perform something that I do with stuff, like I add milk to my coffee. See, that's human scale. I've got this thing right here, and I add something to it, right? It's only an extremely creative bit of packing that we can say, okay, I've got this one year and I'm going to add something to it. I'm not adding something to the year. There just happens to be one day after another, but I can conceive of this by using my packing to something for which I have a change. And this is a very standard form of packing and unpacking. Out here, across all of these things, what we have are analogies and disanalogies. And these are vital relations. And you will see that what we do frequently is pack this outer space network into a blend where the analogies are packed into an identity, the year. So across all this range of days, there are certain kinds of analogies. That period of seasons was like this period of seasons, like that period of seasons, like that period of seasons. Those are analogies, and they get compacted into an identity. Now down here we get the year. And there are disanalogies across all these input spaces, namely, now there is, well, over here, there are 365 days in this year, and there are 366 days in this year. And I didn't change this year. I didn't add anything to this year. There were these 365 days, then those 366. I didn't add anything here. But now I compress the analogies to an identity, the year, and I compress the disanalogies to change. For that identity. The fact that this year is different from this year now becomes I changed the year, but nothing changed in the previous years. Down here in the blend, I have an identity and it changes. No one's fooled. We don't now think that the year before has an extra day, or that we added a day and now we've changed the year. No, the identity down here has a change. But in the network, we can expand it to understand there are all these analogies and disanalogies, and we pack and we unpack, and we pack and we unpack. And this is how it operates. We say something like, kick the habit. Now notice, when you have a habit, what like my drinking coffee, what it means is, after lunch, I went and got coffee one day, and the next day I went and got coffee, and the next day I went and got coffee, and the next day I went and got coffee. And I did that again and again and again and again. What's the habit? The habit is a compression over, it's a packing of those analogies across these days. Now I have in the blend a thing. It's my habit. And I can do things with my habit. I can kick my habit. Now notice this is really very interesting. How is it that on one day I don't have coffee? And I can say, I'm kicking my habit, or I'm letting go of my habit, or I'm banishing my habit. Down here in the packed blend, I have one thing, and I can change it. The disanalogy is change, packed to change. The analogy is packed to identity. Your agent is waiting for you. This is an advertisement I saw for airlines. And it was for a worldwide airline. So there were pictures of all these gate agents and ticket agents, and some were in China and some were in Thailand. There's always one person in one country. And you go everywhere, and in the Philippines, in Mexico, in Sweden, they had pictures of all these agents, and then here they had one agent. Your agent is waiting for you. Now, of course, what is this, your agent? Well, it's a compression. All the places you go, there's somebody there willing to help you. Doesn't know you, right? But now, in the blend, it's your agent. There's a role, your agent. And of course, for the agent, it's a compression that there's a you. Because up here, there are many, 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 many different customers. Many different agents waiting on many different customers in many different places. But down here in the blend, we have a person waiting for another person, your agent. In what sense is this my agent? This agent does not know me. But when I interact with an agent, that agent knows me. So now all of my interactions with other agents are compacted down to a possessive for this role. This is now my agent. So I can say, well, my agent in Russia will handle this, even though I have not met the agent. I know that there is one. When I go to the counter, now I don't pull out my electrical gear and plug it into the wall. I pull out my frame for me at the counter with an agent. And I say, I'm looking for my agent, right? Because I expect it to work. I expect to be able to unpack my frame and apply it to the local situation. The customer is always right. His girlfriend gets younger every year. Now that could mean that she's aging backwards. She used to be 30 and now she's 29. It would be false, people don't do that, but you can imagine a science fiction novel in which that happened. His girlfriend gets younger every year because she's got that special disease that makes you age in the opposite direction. I could make a lot of money by patenting that disease, I'm sure. The story is, that's not the way we interpret this. We mean there are different girlfriends and there are disanalogies. There are analogies. He's always got a girlfriend. This, I think, comes out of a James Bond movie. There's always a girlfriend, but it's a different woman. And there are disanalogies in her age up here. But down here, he's got one girlfriend, the role, and the disanalogies become change for that identity. His girlfriend gets younger every year. Makes perfect sense. Now, nobody thinks that human beings get younger. Actually, that's false. But we're not deluded. In the blend, there's getting younger. The getting younger is not in any of the input spaces for any of those individuals. But we pack down our knowledge of this man. Now we have a little packed thing. His girlfriend gets younger. And we can expand this the next time we meet him with a girlfriend. You want to get your tennis serve back. I went on, Sculpting in Time Coffee is next to Deep Tennis, which I love. Everybody's playing tennis. Now, if there's something you can do, this day and this day and this day and this day, and then you start not to be able to do it, and pretty soon you're not doing it. Well, where is the thing? This is just a set of analogies and disanalogies. But now in the blend, you have a thing. You have a tennis serve. Your ability to do this now becomes one identical thing. And change comes from compacting the analogies. If you could do it, and you could do it, and you could do it, and you could do it, then you started not to be able to do it, and then you started to be able to do it. These are just differences. They're not changes for a thing. They're differences. Every day there's a different thing, but it's not a changed thing. But it's so natural for us double scope blenders to compress this down into something for which there's a change. Now the change is he gets it back as if it is an object. Your French has disappeared, for example. If you lose the ability that you, and even the way I'm talking about it now, lose, right? You have something, you lose it, it disappears, right? We have these little packed conceptions that we can use to grasp networks that are much bigger than we can actually store. We construct them on the fly, we make sense of things, and then we repack and we move on. This is not generation and use, or retrieval and use. This is generation and connection, packing and unpacking. Gilles Fauconnier came up with this example. He received a bill in an envelope. It was for his electrical use. And the back of the envelope said, "Make this envelope disappear." It was a request that he sign up for electronic reception of his bill instead of receiving something in the mail. So what they wanted was, he received every month a bill, this month, 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 and then not this month, not this month, not this month. So there's analogies, that is, you get a bill every month, but then there are disanalogies. There was paper this month, but electronic this month. That gets compressed in the blend to now one thing, this envelope. Now it's impossible to make this envelope disappear, right? It's here. It's not going anywhere. He's not supposed to say abracadabra and make this envelope disappear, right? The analogies, you're getting a bill. You're getting, there's something that has to come to you. Come down as one thing, this envelope. And the change, namely next time it's electronic, gets compressed, or rather the disanalogy, the difference, gets compressed as change, disappear. Now no one is deluded. No one thinks that the envelope is actually going to disappear. But this is a way we can grasp this and hold on to it. We pack it into something at human scale, and we carry these things around and unpack them. So here is an illustration of what I mean. You have mental spaces, you have a lot of experience, people say things to you. Often what they say is like something else you have heard. You're in a different room. You're in a different airport. And there are analogies across these things. But that's a lot of information. That's a lot of stuff. There are also disanalogies across these things. And you can compress the analogies into identity, and the disanalogies into change. In fact, this is the compression of some kinds of vital relations into more human scale vital relations. You can so even make one more step, and that is compress all of the identities into a uniqueness, a unique thing, which is inside a mental space, like this envelope or his girlfriend. And you can compress the changes that are between mental spaces into change for that unique thing. This is an extremely common pattern, not by any means the only one, just one. I want to stick with sort of one of these kinds of examples for a little while today, that comes up again and again and again and again in human cognition. And it's not that you lose the others. It's not that you lose the network. You can always unpack this change for uniqueness into a much larger, more diffuse network that is grounded in a blend that has a very human scale frame. So, briefly, you know, two steps in one, when you have these analogies and disanalogies, the analogical vital relations can be compressed down into a unique thing, conceptually, and the differences can be compressed down to change. We do this linguistically. We may hear that when we hear different people speak, there are strong analogies in the way they speak, but there are also disanalogies in the way we speak, and we can say, aha, They're both using the same kind of construction, but one of them pronounces it or deploys it just a little differently than the other. And when you encounter a speaker of that language, and you're trying to make sense of what they say, you have this little packet, and you expand it to take in what they're doing. And so everybody you encounter has the possibility to change just a little your linguistic knowledge, not necessarily your own accent, although that can happen too. And again, I emphasize, this is very important. When you look at a theory of language, it has to take on board actual facts of language. There's an awful lot of study, descriptive study, of change in language. We know that languages change. The theory of what language is has to have a place for at least trying to account for the facts of language diachrony, of language change. So this has in fact been studied in various kinds of ways by Eve Sweetser, who points out in an article on change predicates, sentences like, the cars get 3 feet bigger when you enter Pacific Heights. All right, now what that Pacific Heights is a neighborhood. It's a rich neighborhood. Now notice, okay, so this says the cars get 3 feet bigger when you enter Pacific Heights, and it's interpreted as meaning the cars that you find parked in Pacific Heights are larger than the cars in the other neighborhoods. Now note, obviously, but I have to point it out, no car got bigger. All the cars stayed exactly the same size they were. It's just that there were analogies and disanalogies across the cars that you saw. There were cars. That's the analogy. You're in this neighborhood and you see lots of cars, and you drive into Pacific Heights and you see lots of cars. And there are disanalogies, and the disanalogies are compressed into change. The cars get 3 feet bigger. Now, nobody actually thinks the cars grow, but you have that conception, and more importantly, you can say this in language about the blend, where there is a set of things, the cars, and they change. And this can be used to understand this vast set of disanalogies. Or the fences get taller as you move westward across the United States. This is just the normal way to say things. Notice, no fence got taller, right? The fences, in one sense, did not get taller. It didn't mean all the fences, you know, I'm moving across the United States driving westward, which I'm about to do. It's not that all of the fences out there say, oh, Mark Turner is coming, let's get 3 feet taller. Grow up, right? That's not what it means. This sentence could mean that. It would be grammatical for that situation, but that's not what it means. In a science fiction novel or something, it's not what it means. We don't interpret it that way. We could. It's one way to take it. What it means is that there is a blend in which there's a set of stuff and changes for that set of stuff. And we unpack it to apply to the world that we're in, right? Construct a big network, but within we don't just keep the big network. Now, we pack to human scale through blending. And I'm working today on mental packing and unpacking as a way of thinking about knowledge and language and your little pack of stuff that you take with you. It's not the case that everything you, quote, know about language has to already be set in your head. No, what you need is a pack. You need a suitcase that you can unpack, maybe using memory sometimes as an aid. You can unpack it to work, right? What you need to be able to do is to generate and work. That's what you need to be able to do in situations. Okay. There's a place called, and I'm talking about the way this is crucial for language. There is a place called Lake Tahoe in California. and they have bears. And the bears are wild. Now, the problem is that Lake Tahoe is a resort area, and the local people living in Lake Tahoe know that you should leave the wildlife to be wild. But many people from San Francisco and surrounding areas go up to Lake Tahoe, and many of them do not understand what a wild bear is or how to treat it. So they try to do very nice things. That is, they've got their packed knowledge, and they go up to Lake Tahoe and they try to unpack it to fit into Lake Tahoe. One of the things they've got is how nice it is to feed the cute animals. They have dogs, they have pets, they go to the zoo, they buy food at the zoo to feed to the animals. You can only feed them certain kinds of food. But they have this knowledge. And it's packed little knowledge. Oh, go, have fun, see cute animals, feed cute animals. Okay, fine. And they go to Lake Tahoe. The problem is that nobody's crazy enough actually to feed a grown bear. I don't know if you've seen a grown bear. They certainly have bears in China. But bears are kind of scary. But what you can do is throw food to the cubs. You can also leave food and go inside. Now, there are other kinds of things that you can do. You can throw food in the garbage that you mean to be taken away. You don't mean the bears to eat it, but they do. They come and get it out of the garbage can. They're very good at that. Or in your temporary little resort home that you have up in Lake Tahoe, you can plant fruit trees. Why not? Let's have an orchard. This is my fun little area. I'm unpacking my knowledge of houses. I'll put some trees in here. So you have 6 fruit trees. The bears come and eat that. The problem is that if the bears get used to eating human food near human beings, then they will approach the human beings. Or if they won't, then their offspring will, because they've been conditioned to it, right? So they want you not to feed the bears. They have to change somehow your conception of the bears. So all over Lake Tahoe, there is this sign, all over, in the bookstores, and they've explained all of this a million times to all the tourists, and it doesn't work. This worked. A fed bear is a dead bear. Now notice, there's only one bear, okay? One bear, not all the bears, one bear. And it is being fed. Nobody would feed a bear, but that's a scene we all have. And who is feeding the bear? Do you recognize this? Do you recognize what that is? It's a cultural symbol. No? Good, because it's a compression. It's something we call the Grim Reaper. The Grim Reaper is a mythical being who comes along and takes you away when you die. In fact, makes you die. Right? The Grim Reaper. Reaping is what we do to plants. We cut them down. Okay? And this instrument he has in his hand, in his left hand, that's a scythe. That's a blade for cutting down the plants. Okay? Now, the Grim Reaper is an amazing compression. I won't linger on this too long. But what I want to say is one kind of compression we have is to create a universal cause. There are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of different individual deaths, each of which has an individual cause, and they can be quite different. Some people die of illness, some people die of old age, some people die of infection, some people die of cancer, which is not an infection, it's your own body doing something. Some people die of an accident, some people die by being murdered, all these different ways of dying, right? So if I say, for starters, the event of dying is compressed into an event, death. No one can escape death. And we compress all those different causes into, it's a tautology, into a universal cause. Death. What causes death? Death. You can't escape death. What causes hunger? Hunger. Hunger makes you hungry, right? What causes lust? Lust. Lust causes lust. You know, sleep makes you sleepy, right? Now, we know when we think about it that this is kind of crazy, right? But it's crazy in an extremely inventive way. We compress down into our little packet, there's death. Death comes to everyone. And we can unpack that to make sense of all kinds of different deaths. So for starters, there's a general cause death. This is part of the general pattern of causal tautology that human beings use all the time. Next, there's a reaper. Reapers cut down plants. But notice the reapers don't kill the plants. The plants grow back up. And there are lots of them, not just one. And they're not grim. People out in the field cutting down the corn or so on are not in heavy clothes and being very grim. On the contrary, sometimes they're singing. But there's another thing, and that is the killer. The killer can wait for you. The killer is coming just for you. The killer knows that you are there. So you have three things going on here. The killer, the reaper, and the personification of the general cause of death. Death now is a person. This is a blend, an enormous blend of first a compression to make general death, then a blend with a person to make personified death, then a blend of personified death with a reaper and a killer. So down in the big compression that you get is the grim reaper. There's one. He's grim, that's because of the killing, and he's the reaper. Death, the grim reaper. One word sort of for each of these kinds of inputs, right? Now that's one part of this blend. So the grim reaper represents death. It's an amazing compression down into this little packet. But that's only the beginning. Now what about the bear? Well, as I said, there, the bear eats, the bear eats, the bear eats, the bear eats, the bear has little kids, the bears eat, they bear analogies and analogies and disanalogies, right? And they're just analogies and disanalogies. But we compress those down into the species, the Lake Tahoe bear. The Lake Tahoe bear is being changed. It's being changed by becoming comfortable with human beings. So it approaches human beings, and then the fish and game officials have to come and shoot it. So a fed bear is a dead bear. Now notice it doesn't mean that the bear you feed dies instantly. Maybe some other bears are going to die, right? But no, they want to compress this down many to one, human scale, compress the time frame, compress the causality. Think of the causal links out here. You want to have fun in Tahoe, you buy a house, you plant the tree, up grows the fruit, bears come and eat the fruit. Pretty soon the little bears think, since mama bear is doing it, they can eat the fruit. They come and eat the fruit. The little bears grow up and are now not cute. They're terrifying. They're coming into your backyard or somebody else's backyard because they learned they could do that. Somebody else is terrified that there's a big bear in the backyard, and they call up the fish and game officer to come and shoot it. A very long chain of cause and effect out here gets compressed down to a direct cause in the blend. All these different bears become one bear. All this different activity becomes one action, feeding. So now planting an orchard gets compressed with feeding. And the causation is instantaneous. A fed bear is a dead bear, right? So we have this bear network now, and we also have another possibility here, and that is the frame of poisoning. You You can kill an animal by poisoning it, right? By feeding it something. That's not actually linguistically there, but it might be there conceptually for some people. And what we get is this enormous, packed little thing that we're supposed to take around if we're a tourist in Lake Tahoe, where you feed the bear and the bear dies. That's it. You are the Grim Reaper. Now the compression is you are the cause of death. You are the thing that causes death, and you mean to. Your intentionality is now created in the blend. You are bad. You're doing the wrong thing. You should feel ashamed. Naughty, naughty, naughty. In the blend. This is an attempt to change your conception of who you are and what the bear is, so that when you go out into the world of Lake Tahoe and unpack your conception, you will behave differently. You won't put your trash in the garbage unless it's a special walking garbage can a bear can't get into. You won't leave food in your car without just thinking about it. You won't plant an orchard. And when you look at this compression, when you look at this, see, down the arm, by the way, the cowl, the reason the Grim Reaper is wearing this is that these are robes associated with funerals and death. And the Grim Reaper is a skeleton. Now think of that, by the way. Up here you have somebody dies, they get buried. Gradually they decay, but the thing that's left is a skeleton. Long chain of time, long chain of causation. Gets compressed down into the blend. Now, the cause of death has as its form a skeleton. That is a metonymy compression that is really, really strong, right? Takes all those outer space causal connections and compresses them down into form. Now, that's about the tightest metonymy you can get, right? And it's you. And if you look at the arm, along the arm, it says bird seed, orchards, you know, all these different kinds of forms of providing food, even if you didn't mean to provide the food, become feeding in the blend. Now, nobody's deluded. Nobody thinks that he or she is the Grim Reaper. Nobody thinks that they're actually, that this means actually you shouldn't walk up to a bear and try to give it something, because pretty much bears are too scary to do that. But you can carry it around and unpack it. And when you roam around in the world, it will change your behavior, right? A fed bear is a dead bear, by the way. This is something I won't go into. The rhyme is an attempt to create a greater compression. You know, if they had said a fed bear is a killed bear, that would probably have been more accurate, because the Fish and Game officer is going to show up and kill the bear. But a fed bear is a dead bear, is a much tighter phonological equation. Fed, dead, right? And this may seem strange, but a great deal of the world's poetry, and in fact insults, and things that children say to each other to taunt each other, depends upon phonological equation for conceptual equation. If you hear children in the United States taunt each other by saying, "Mary, Mary, Mary, she's really scary," right? And kids hate it when you do something with their name, because the name is connected to their essence, and if you can equate the name with a description, somehow the universe has provided an equation. Somehow her very name now carries this association, certainly memorable. Once when I was in the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, I heard somebody say, because these are mountains, right? And somebody said to the tour driver, "At what altitude do the deer turn into elk?" Now that's very funny, because of course you can hear it now. It sounds like the deer are going to turn into elk. What she meant was, you go up the mountain on the road and they're deer, 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 then elk, 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 elk. No deer turns into an elk, right? But there's an altitude, and there are analogies across all of this, and that is, there are these animals. And down here, they're deer, and up there, they're elk. Nobody thinks deer turn into elk, but you can say at what altitude do the deer turn into elks? Identity, change for the identity. Now here's the kind of thing you won't notice. The new theory is that dinosaurs turned into birds. Now we'll look at that in a minute. But notice, it's in the blend that the dinosaurs turn into birds. It doesn't mean that any dinosaur turned into a bird, or that there's any turning going on. My tax bill, this is from Gilles Foucanier, my tax bill gets bigger every year. Perfectly normal way to say this. In the United States and in many Western countries, we get a tax bill every year. We have to figure out what taxes we owe the federal government, and we have to pay them. So, analogy, tax bill. This one is more expensive than this one, right? Bigger meaning more expensive. So now, in the blend, the analogies are compressed to the tax bill, it's yours, and it gets bigger. This is a little packet to carry around, and next year, when it's time to pay the tax bill, you can expand it. It doesn't mean that you actually think that any one of your tax bills gets bigger. It doesn't. The president changes every 4 years. Now, that could mean, you know, every 4 years he grows or shaves his beard. But that's not what it means. It means there's a role, and the value of the role changes every 4 years. So let's look at these dinosaurs. Dinosaurs evolved into birds, we say. Now, of course we know in the theory of evolution that there's no teleology, there's no intention of the organism to evolve. We know that what happens is there are some organisms, and some of them die, and some of them live, and they all die sooner or later, and their offspring, and then they die, and so on. And there are differences, there are disanalogies across all these organisms as you go through time. Well, it's just irresistible to say things like, the scrub jay developed bigger wings. Of course, no scrub jay developed any bigger wing. Its wing was just what it was. But here are the scrub jays over time. The analogies are compressed to the scrub jay, and the disanalogies to change, develop. Right? We can say things like, the giraffe grew a longer neck. It didn't grow any longer neck. All giraffes had just the neck they had. This is the very standard, we say dinosaurs turned into birds, dinosaurs became birds. Strictly, scientifically, by which I mean in this case, only looking at all these outer space diffuse knowledge, that's false. It's true for the blend. But that doesn't mean we should get rid of the blend. On the contrary, that's the packet we carry. There are many things I know about language that are false about actual performance. But that's not because I'm deluded, it's because I have to unpack what I know about language when I engage with language. I don't have to carry around with me all of that knowledge, I have to be able to pack and unpack. So here is what started all of this. I found this in Zoo Books, which was a book for kids. One of my kids got Zoo Books every month. So this was his monthly zoo book. Notice the compression. Now there's one, and it comes every month. All those different things are now your monthly zoo book. It's like your afternoon coffee. One dinosaur on one path. The lighting sort of suggests that it's a uniform scene. You're getting different pictures of the dinosaur in times it's chasing the dragonfly, and it starts to get more bird-like. And at the end, it's a bird, and hey, look at that. Now it can actually catch the dragonfly, right? The dinosaur turned into a bird, right? Well, what's going on is, of course, lots of different dinosaurs. They live, they die. There are disanalogies and analogies. That gets compressed to the dinosaur, a species, who changes, right? The analogies get compressed into the dinosaur, the identity, and there are changes across that. And then in this case, you get compression to a unique element who changes as it goes along the path. Now there's something else here that happens. It happens very often in blending. You create more vital relations for the blend to make it stronger and more memorable. In this blend, the dinosaur wants to catch the dragonfly. The dinosaur wants to evolve. Now we know that's false for evolution. That's not the way you should think of it. But we all sort of carry that around, and we just know that when we unpack, we better not think that way. We better not think that the species actually want to evolve. One of my favorite books when I was in mathematics, it's a little tiny book called Counterexamples in Mathematics, because there are lots of things that you will think about mathematics that are not actually true because there's a counterexample. But you still carry them around because they're very useful. You just remember that there's a counterexample, so when you unpack this thing, this mathematical knowledge you have, you better say, wait, is this thing actually integrable over a Lagrange space? You stop yourself a little as you unpack. You do this when you do accounts, right? You, for any technical knowledge you have, you carry around things, and when you unpack it to actually work on something, you check. You say, wait, better be careful as I'm unpacking this here. Could get this wrong. Okay? Now, once you see this, you will see this all over the place. It is the main way in which political cartoons are written. Political cartoons are sort of instantly understandable. They're culturally embedded, and so sometimes you just won't get it. It's like if you don't know who the Grim Reaper is, you won't recognize him on the Lake Tahoe poster. Well, I was in Berlin, and on the day I was going to give a lecture, this political cartoon appeared in the newspaper. The main headline was World Food Crisis. And in this political cartoon, there's a pudgy American who's fueling up his car, right? And it's a green car, and it says, "Go Green," and he's filling it with bioethanol, right? So he has all the trappings of caring about the environment. In fact, part of what we see in here is the cartoonists editorializing. The bioethanol is called pure corn. Now, you wouldn't know this maybe, but in American English, pure corn means nonsense. And you would never find the gas pump of bioethanol, which is a corn product, the ethanol, a little bit mixed with the gas. And it's supposed to help the environment a little by not burning so much gas, by making less carbon, smaller carbon footprint, also a blend. So that's coming in as a way of saying that this guy is stupid, got the wrong idea. And we take that as the cartoonist editorializing. Now, over there are two characters whom we take to represent the hungry of the world, right? Notice that they're sort of standing on the other side of a curve that could be sort of taken as the edge of the globe, so they're in continents far away. Now, this is completely spectacular. One of them is holding up, a rice peasant horn hat and so on. He's got perhaps a rice bowl and a classic gesture of supplication. And the American is saying, "Sorry, I'm busy saving the planet," right? Now, it's completely impossible that the world's hungry could show up two at a time in a gas station in the American Midwest and make a gesture of supplication like this. Completely impossible. The American cannot see the world's hungry who are in different continents. They probably don't understand English, right? Everything about this is false for the outer space connections. But it's a basic human scene. There is need, there's somebody right in front of you who is asking for something, and you say no, and you give an excuse. And your excuse is silly, because it is self-serving. You see this, and you are supposed to now carry around this little packet to unpack when you think about the world food crisis, and this is what America is doing. Notice this isn't just one guy at a gas station in the American Midwest. This is now a representative of America. I'm going to pass over that one because I want to now say for 7 minutes the direct application of this to the conception of linguistic packets that you carry around. Okay? So let's take, for example, something like caused motion clause in English. Now, the caused motion clause is one of the basic clause types in English and in many other languages. What do I mean by that? Well, caused motion is a very basic human scene. An agent performs an action on an object that causes it to move in a direction. So you pick up the stone, you throw it. You push the wagon. You pull the cup. You lift the cup. You perform an action on an object that causes it to move in a direction. This is a basic embodied scene. All human beings know it. It's in your bones. Okay? Now, there are certain verbs in English that are directly cause motion verbs. A verb like throw. Throw means an agent, it has places in the frame, and it has arguments, which means places for other linguistic elements. I threw the ball over the fence, okay? Throw already carries an agent performing an action on an object to cause it to move in a direction, and there's probably a little something in there about the manner of the action, the means, and the manner of the motion that's caused, okay? So, but there's also a clause, noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, prepositional phrase that is attached linguistically to this knowledge. And you can use that clause to indicate to people that you'd like them to make a blend, a cause-motion blend. So suppose, for example, there's a diffuse scene in which some stuff happens. There are some tanks. They want to come into the compound. It's not so easy for them to come into the compound. Some effort has to be taken to get them into the compound. But they finally end up in the compound. Okay? So there's motion by the tanks. And I say, how did the tanks get into the compound? And somebody says, oh, the officer waved the tanks into the compound. Noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, prepositional phrase. What that means is there's a bunch of diffuse stuff out here that you need to manage. And I want you to take the cause motion scene and blend that stuff with a cause motion frame. And now in the frame you have a compact little blend in which there was an agent who performed an action on an object that caused the object to move in a direction. Even though wave is not a cause motion verb, it now becomes a cause motion verb or prompts for a cause motion packet to help you conceive of this situation. Now, did I have to have in my knowledge that wave can be used in a caused motion clause? Did I ever have to hear that before in order to understand this or even to say it? No. What I had is a little packet. I have a caused motion clause. And over here, I have a verb, wave, for a communicative action that somebody makes. And I put them together. I blend them as a way of asking you to blend the concepts. And down in the blend, you now have a human scale packet that you can use. So it goes like this. Here's one input. This is your cause motion frame attached to a cause motion clause. Then there's a bunch of stuff over here that's diffuse. And I say things like, this is Adele Goldberg's example, Paul sneezed the napkin off the table. Sneeze, as she says, is a parade example of an intransitive verb. But now it is in a clause that takes three arguments. Paul sneezed the napkin off the table. Now, let me point out, I am prompting you for a certain kind of blend, a certain kind of packet. Suppose I say, Paul sneezed the napkin off the table, and you say, what does that mean? And I said, oh, Paul sneezed. I thought he might want to blow his nose, so I lifted my napkin off the table and gave it to him. And you say, that's not what that can mean, because nobody's going to understand it that way. And I say, why not? My expression, my story, my explanation is Paul, it's got sneeze, and it's got the napkin that comes off the table. No good. Why? Because putting it into that clause asked for a cause motion scene, and with Paul as the agent. I can say, Junior sped the car around the Christmas tree. Where does speed come from? It's the manner of the motion of, it's the manner of the caused motion. So now I can take all kinds of things, all kinds of words from all over the diffuse network, and I can put them into the cause motion clause, prompting you to come up with a network that you can manage because you've got a nice cause motion blend. Here's the cause motion network. Now notice, I can say things like, I walked him into the room, right? Walk is not a cause motion verb. He sneezed the napkin off the table. I pointed him toward the door. These are all noun phrase, verb phrase, noun phrase, prepositional phrase. They teased him out of his senses. This is, of course, we would say this is metaphoric, and indeed it is, but the action and the causation are not metaphoric. It's cause-motion blend. I will talk you through the procedure. I read him to sleep. They prayed the two boys home. I muscled the box into place. Muscle now is part of the manner of the causal action, but it can come in as a verb. Hunk choked the life out of him. Now pay attention to this. Hunk did not choke, and Hunk did not choke the life. This is not building up from those constructions. What happened is we understand this as Hunk did something with a result for an object. And the result is that the object was dead. And metaphorically, we understand this as change of state is change of location. So the life goes out of him, right? Or he floated the boat to me. Float doesn't have to mean there's any motion at all. It can also even be used in the case where you're stopping the motion. We blocked him from the door. Now that's pretty interesting. The point here is that as I roam around the world and you roam around the world, I do not need to have complete command of all of the things that I might produce. In order, or that I might have to understand. What I have to have is a little packet of stuff that can lock together with the context, with the environment that I'm in, and create a network that I can understand, that's at human scale, that will let me understand the frame structure, the causal structure, the modal structure that's in this network. And I don't have to have new language. None of these requires new linguistic constructions. These are all unifications, selective unifications, leaving some things behind, of linguistic constructions that we have to use in order to prompt for elaborate networks. It's the same with the resultative. I boiled the pan dry. Think, no zucchini tonight, honey. No zhongzi tonight, honey. I boiled the pan dry. Now, think of the long causal chain. Notice, I didn't boil, and I didn't boil the pan. This is the resultative. You can say, Kathy painted the wall white, which means Kathy performed an action. You don't know what it was. Maybe she used a spray gun. Maybe she used a paintbrush. Maybe she ordered somebody to do it. Maybe she wasn't even there. With the result that paint was applied to the object and turned the object white. Okay? Now, Kathy painted the wall white does not mean Kathy painted the wall because she's white. Kathy painted the wall, although it was white. It doesn't mean any of those kinds of things. It means Kathy painted the wall with the result that the wall became white. It's a result of it. And I can use that now for I boiled the pan dry. You don't know what I did, but you know there was something that happened in there. Water boiled. Water was not even mentioned. The result is that the pan became dry. So grammatical constructions like I boiled the pan dry are, or rather like the resultative clause and verbs like boil and dry and so on, are little bits in your packet, your roll-on bag, that you can unpack and put together and make it use to make a network and take care of that situation. And just as for the cause motion scene, look at the compressions you can get. Catherine painted the wall white. She kissed him unconscious. That's Goldberg's example. That doesn't mean she kissed him although he was unconscious. It means she kissed him so well that he just passed out, right? She kissed him with the result that he went unconscious. Last night's meal made me sick. Now, this runs over many hours. He hammered it flat. I boiled the pan dry. The earthquake shook the building apart. And here's one I love. Roman imperialism made Latin universal. Now, Latin is not a thing, and universal is not a feature. But in the blend, it is. Roman imperialism is not an agent. But in the blend, Roman imperialism becomes an agent that works on an object, namely Latin, with the result that Latin becomes universal. It has a feature. It's the same mental structure as Catherine painted the wall white, except now it runs over centuries and hundreds of thousands of people and vast causal connections, okay? So this is what we're going to be exploring in the future, the way in which linguistic structure consists of small prompts that you can blend to prompt for blending in mental networks as you pack and unpack in order to understand the world. Thank you.